Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Burning Butch by R.B. Mertz. Read by R.B. Mertz.
I found that life was beautiful only because I found that your life was beautiful. Francesco, 1991.
Overture disclaimer. I imagine many people would prefer if I hadn't written this book, or if I had made it about someone else who lived somewhere else. In an effort to tell the truth and protect the privacy of everyone whose story is intertwined with mine, I made a genuine effort to obscure identifying traits without altering the narrative. If I was going to lie, I would have gotten laid a lot more. For the big kids and the little kids, and for Mom and for Bob.
Love. It's a new style. On the other hand, our old ways were once new. Fiddler on the Roof.
Chapter 1. Hurricane. 2019. I sit on the table at the front of the room, waiting for my new students to arrive for our first 8 o'clock class. It's fall, they're first-year students, and it's Monday at 8 a.m. I'll be their first college professor. The first thing they'll notice about me is my clothes, my hair, my gender. They've gotten into a semi-exclusive Catholic college, and they aren't expecting to find a queer in charge of them, at least not such a loud one. They won't know how to categorize me, and it'll scare them. "Are you the teacher?" a student asks me, entering the room, looking a little excited. She has long blonde hair. My mom always said my hair was strawberry blonde, but as I get older, it gets more auburn, like it's settled solidly in between two poles. Most of my head is shaved, queer right out of the proverbial gate, like a proud anti-Samson, giving God's power right back to him. There was a time I couldn't have imagined looking like this, when I was afraid to even cut my hair above my chin, when I had to imagine being stranded on a deserted island like the girl in the Swiss Family Robinson to be allowed to cut my hair as short as I wanted, like a boy. Since I'm getting better and better at being broke, I'm as thin as I get, even muscly in some places, with a little feminist belly. I'm wearing tight jeans, a bright blue button-down shirt with a tie and a vest, and black nail polish on one hand, the one without love tattooed across the knuckles. I look far less traditional than any of my students, but they'll never look conservative to me if they're not wearing t-shirts with the Virgin Mary on the front, tucked into long cotton prairie skirts, like the girls I grew up with. In a shirt like this one, with the sleeves rolled all the way up, they can see the tattoos on each of my biceps, an unfinished Howard Finster angel on my left, and the circle drawing from Hedwig and the Angry Inch on my right. "Yeah," I say, chuckling, "I'm the teacher." Those words ring a little in my ears, because to me, teachers were always special people, like actors or priests up there performing one-person shows for everyone, sometimes with music. I always had crushes on them, from kindergarten onward. I remember kicking my feet under the dining room table, chattering on and on about Miss Souter, and Mom looking up at me like she was amused and scared at the same time, and I could tell she wasn't saying something that she was thinking. "What?" I'd ask. "Nothing," she'd said. The 22 freshmen assembled before me looked more or less the same. Almost everyone's skin is the same beige color, their hair the same shades of light brown and blonde. Nearly all the girls have long, straightened hair, and all the boys have short hair, even for boys. All but two or three are wearing something that says the name of their school across the front, in navy blue or blood red. When I was their age, I had long hair too. I remember not understanding how to choose clothing, not feeling good in any of it. I was the oldest of seven kids and paid for everything with student loans. I didn't have enough spending money for a hoodie that bore the name of my college or even a t-shirt, but I remember wishing I could have one, wishing I could look just like everyone else. Still, no matter what clothes I wore, I never seemed to look like them. For years, I only shopped in the girls' section, then the juniors' section, then the women's section, like I was supposed to. I write my name on the board, Mertz, my bad dad's name, the name I didn't share with my mother since she'd remarried and become a Tuttle. Every situation that required us to produce identification resulted in confusion because we had different last names. Was I really hers or was I his? As soon as I'd started teaching, the summer after grad school, my students started calling me Mertz and nothing else. intuiting that the Ms., Miss., and Mrs. they'd relied on thus far wouldn't work for me. Nor was I a doctor or a professor or even technically an instructor. Eventually, I accepted what I had resisted for most of my childhood. I was just Mertz. Most people had been resisting the girl name I was born with since I was a kid, opting for the last name that had the satisfying tss sound at the end, not to mention recalling Fred and Ethel from I Love Lucy. But they were dead now, and so was my dad, not even in reruns anymore, because there are no reruns. Now it was my name. Now it meant me. "Are you the teacher?" another one asks, baffled as she enters late. I confirm it again. They'd all been told they were going to a conservative school, and there I was, one of their first professors. I'm like a professor, the same way I'm like a girl, like a boy, like a Mertz, and not one at all. Like a daughter to my stepdad, like a parent to my siblings, like a sister to my mom, like a lover to so many women who didn't want to admit it, like. Adjunct means a thing added to something else, as a supplementary rather than essential part. And for a while now, I've realized I've always been adjunct. Half daughter, half sibling, half boy, half girl, half Catholic, half Protestant, half Democrat, half Republican, half young, half old, half mom, half dad, split down the middle. My students will notice that my clothes aren't as nice as theirs, that I can't stay organized, that I lose track of things, that I'm not as good at keeping deadlines, and that I smoke too many cigarettes. Most of the adjuncts I know are writers, most of them poets like me. One foot in the world and one out of it, teaching like airline pilots, because we love to fly, not because it'll get us anywhere. They don't say she's the most organized in my evaluations, I always say on the first day, before I ask them to go around the room and say their names and their favorite things. Our favorite things, like the sound of music? One girl, blithe, asks enthusiastically. Oh, I love that movie, another one says, and several agree. You like musicals? I ask them suspiciously, not really believing it. A chorus of oh yes floods the room. Not everyone is talking, but the vocal majority are enthusiastically swapping which musicals are their favorites and what they've seen or haven't, and I wonder what it would be like to be young among them. PTSD whispers to me every day that all the things that happened before will happen again, but my students remind me that I don't know everything. I'm not stuck in that old loop. I'm not a movie. I'm a live show, and I'm distracted by memories of my freshman year of college and how different the world was then, and how it was the same, too, like flicking a light switch off and on in a room over and over again. I'm supposed to teach them about the significance, the power of stories, but mine is still confusing to me. I ask them absentmindedly if they have any questions for me. Where did you go to college? One of them asks me. I tell them. Wait, says one girl, Emily, who has a Choose Life patch on her backpack. Isn't that a religious school? I nod. I wait for a few seconds to see if anyone will ask the obvious question. I straighten the tie beneath my vest so I can do something with my hands, but Emily doesn't ask the question I thought she would. Weren't you sad there? She asks. Yeah, I say, and I laugh a little because it's awkward and a little because, thinking about being there, I could never have imagined surviving at a Catholic school completely out, never mind teaching there. How did you, you know, get like you are? A girl named Adriana asks, knowing what she is asking, but not how to ask it. A lot of therapy, I joke, and don't joke. But really, go to therapy while you're in college and it's free. You'll save a lot of time and money later. I hope the counselors here were better than the ones at my school, and I knew they had to be. One girl, Maddie, looks at me with her mouth dropped open a little. What? I ask, forgetting for a second that we are teacher and student, and just reacting to someone staring at me with her mouth wide open. Nothing, she says quickly, but really, my friend goes there. How did you get out of there? Did you always know you were LGBT? She said the letters carefully, sure to get it right. I laugh a little nervously now. Is this one of those times when I should say that that's too personal a question to answer? Or is this a time when I'm being overly sensitive about boundaries? There's that old man-shaped craw in the back of my throat, stuck between me and the truth about myself. I've always been this way, but I didn't always look this way, I say. But that doesn't matter. Some people realize things about themselves early, others later. Others shift from one way of being to another. The important thing, I think, is knowing that you can and that the world won't end. I laugh, at least not because of that. They laugh, but they still want more answers. Look, I say, part of how I learned to be myself was reading and writing, and I think you'll know what I mean when I give you my little first day of class speech. It's about Frederick Douglass and how during slavery it was illegal for enslaved people to learn to read or write. For one thing, enslaved people needed a pass to be off of the plantation, so if they could write, they could make their own pass, and that's exactly how the Underground Railroad worked. People wrote their way into freedom, literally, literarily. Douglass taught himself to read and write, and his autobiography is one of the few testaments of what American slavery was like, written by someone who endured it. When people like Douglass went around giving speeches about their experience of slavery, it changed people's minds, to the point that people went to war over what had become the grotesque backbone of their country's economy. People also went to war, I remind them, to defend richer white men's right to own black people, mainly because they identified with that rich white man because he was white. They could see themselves coming into this good fortune of owning people someday too, so they signed up to die and sent their children to die for it too, this possibility of conquering. But what could not be defeated even by the power of all those white American dreams was the voices of black people like Douglass who had survived, like Douglass, the unbelievable. Douglass made people believe. This is just one of countless examples, I tell them, of how writing can change the world, even writing from regular people like them and me. I remind them that Douglass wasn't writing a book about how he'd walked on the moon or won 50 medals at the Olympics. His book was about something that had happened to millions of other people too. His enslavement and even his daring escape were not singular. They were experiences that generations of people had lived through for hundreds of years, risking their lives to see their children, to be with their lovers, to end the torture of themselves and others, to escape towards the words they'd heard about other places that were different. Douglass was writing about something that was considered, especially by those not experiencing it, something normal. Then my 50 minutes are up, and I say goodbye to them, not knowing which ones will drop my class never to return and which ones will become familiar faces maybe over years. After class, Andrea, the girl with long blonde hair, comes up to me and throws herself on the table at the head of the classroom like she's swooning or falling. "I'm a lesbian," Andrea exclaims, followed by a deep sigh. She laughs and I laugh. "Congratulations," I say, not sure if this is the first time she said it out loud or not. I glance around at the back of the classroom, but no one's there for the next class yet. "Sorry, is that too personal?" she asks, but continues before I can respond. "I just feel like it's so straight here, you know what I mean? I just, like, had to say it out loud. Sometimes I just feel like I'm surrounded by people who don't know anything, you know what I mean?" I laugh a little nervously. This is the kind of conversation I imagine would be safer in an office if I had one. And yet, I think of all the abuses committed behind closed doors, and I think there might be a benefit to having even personal conversations out in the open. Andrea doesn't seem self-conscious at all. "Sorry, is that too personal?" she asks again. "No, no," I say. "I mean, I can imagine it's hard here. It's a little conservative, right? Are many other students out?" "Some are," she says, "but not as many as when I was in high school. In high school, we had an LGBT alliance, and all my high school friends and I came out in, like, 9th grade, but we all went to different colleges." "How do you end up here?" I ask as we exit the classroom, and she continues to follow me down the hall. "Great music program, far enough away from home, but not too far, cool campus." I thought about Bennington for a second, like a girl I couldn't forget. "There's an LGBT alliance here too, isn't there?" I ask, embarrassed that I don't know more. "Oh yeah," she says, "they're cool. There's not that many people in it, but it's good that they exist." "You know what that means, right?" She wrinkles her nose. "Are you going to tell me to go to gay club?" "Absolutely," I said, imitating an old man voice. "In my day, we had to walk barefoot to the gay club, 20 miles uphill in the snow." She laughed. "And when we got there, it wasn't really gay club. They just prayed over us." She laughed again. "I mean, I can't tell you what to do," I said, but I think it would have made a difference to me in college to have a queer community. Nothing's better than people who know what you're talking about when you're talking. It kind of makes up for the people who look at you like you're crazy.
That's true, Andrea nodded, smiling big.
Thanks, Mertz. It's really nice, you know, just having an LGBT teacher up there. See you next week. As I leave the building where I teach, I put on headphones and press play on Mama Cass's Make Your Own Kind of Music. I don't care how corny it is. Once I'm off campus and I'm nobody's teacher, I roll a cigarette and inhale the familiar smoke like a sacrament. I know I'll have to give up this ritual, but I'm still attached to it. It was there for me when nothing else was, when God had left and I was burning, and I couldn't pretend that I wasn't. I walk quickly till I have to stop at a red crosswalk light. People in all kinds of clothes are walking by fast, talking in different accents and languages and codes, happy and angry and excited. Silent people walk by too, mysteriously turning their corners. Sometimes I get moved by everyone on the street, carrying their years, their loves, their aches. It mystifies me, the things we can all carry around with us, and how invisible or not they are to everyone else. There are days I'm still shocked to be alive, to have this life at all. The light turns green. Part 1. Kill Your Darlings. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Genesis chapter 22, verse 9. Chapter 2, Tradition. 1986 to 1987. Mom was determined to get the dress on me. The more she struggled, the more the dress resisted me, and the more I screamed my resistance to the dress. It wasn't too small, and the opening at the neck wasn't too tight for my head to fit through. The neck was unzipped enough. I was too young to put my pain into words. It wasn't the dress that I objected to. Not then, not yet. It was the pin hidden in the dress, the weapon my mother didn't even know was there. She knelt on my bedroom floor beside me while Dad stood in the doorway, looking down on us. Mom had gone the day before to the only place in town to get a dress for a little girl in the rural one video store Pennsylvania town Dad refused to leave. Here they still use needles to attach price tags to clothes. I don't remember what the dress looked like, just the piercing, persistent stab of the needle into my cheek. Dresses were for making women accessible. Women were for making babies. Mothers were for putting dresses on their little girls. Needles were for putting little, imperceptible holes in things. Fathers were for making wounds, poking and interfering and saying you didn't know anything. I could never tell what Mom knew or didn't know. Dad said something that sounded mean. Mom had an MA in economics, but one thing she didn't know yet was that there were men who could love her without saying things like that. The needle was twisting farther and farther into my cheek, and Mom couldn't tell that the harder she pushed, the deeper she was hurting me. She just wanted to get me ready for church without my dad berating her. Finally, I just stopped breathing. I'd screamed so hard that I fainted. A few eerie seconds passed slowly. Mom yanked the dress away and was confronted with my red face, cemented in a wail, the needle sticking out of my bloody cheek. I awoke to her shaking me. As I gasped and whimpered, Mom pulled me close, squeezing me so tight I thought I might stop breathing again, and I beat my fist against her shoulder as I tried to bury my face into her. She wrapped her hand around my clenched fist, brought it up to her mouth, and kissed it. From her arms, I looked up and saw my dad peering down at us, shaking his head. His voice got mean, and I felt Mom's hand move to cover my ear. A year or so later, I'm 3, and he isn't even happy with us in paradise. In the Cayman Islands, where my grandparents had a beach house, I played happily in the sand while my parents fought in the air-conditioned background. My 50-something grandmother, covered in tanning oil with her floral bathing suit top undone so she wouldn't get any tan lines, told me not to listen to them. "Build your little castle, my precious thing," she said to me. I studied the structure I had made thus far, dissatisfied with myself, but determined to make something that looked like the image of a castle I had in my head. I glanced up at the house where I could see a silhouette of my parents arguing. I looked down at what I built, and threw up in the moat. For the rest of the trip, I laid on the living room couch with a fever, vomiting into a bathroom trash can in front of the TV. The only kids' movie at the local video store was Oliver, a Dickensian 1960s musical that mesmerized me with songs and dances and little boys who ran around London without any parents. Dad refused to wear sunscreen and turned bright red. The skin on his face and shoulders was peeling off. He lay across from me on the other couch, grumbling about why anyone would ever come to a place like this. "Just watch your movie and don't worry," Nanny said, putting a cold cloth on my head. Mom was smoking a cigarette on the porch, pacing and talking to my grandfather, her father. Dad watched on grumpily, glowering alternately at my mother and then at the TV. He said something about how no one sang and danced in real life. The kids on the screen were twirling umbrellas around a pretty lady, singing a song about how they loved her and what love meant and how they'd do anything for her. "Anything?" she kept asking them. "Yes," they said, "anything, anything." Within the year, Mom packed up her car in Pennsylvania and brought me to Maryland. For a while, we stayed in my grandparents' big brick house on the farm where Mom grew up, just outside of Washington, D.C., but far enough south in Maryland that the only thing we could see from their house were trees and a two-lane road that could take you everywhere else. There, Mom and I met Bob, who'd been invited to Christmas by my mom's brother because he was new in town and needed somewhere to go. While my dad watched football and ignored me, Bob read to me and talked to my mom. A few months later, under a big greening oak tree, he asked Mom to marry him, and then they both asked me if it would be all right if they did. Nanny and Papa sectioned off a piece of the farm, and Mom and Bob built a house and started having babies. Bob never said mean things. After that, I had to go back to Dad's little town by myself. He and Mom would meet in Breezewood and exchange me over the state line like a package. Sometimes Dad was late to pick me up by hours, and we'd sit in the car and wait and wait. And that was when I learned that you could die in a car and that you could forget about your kid. Dad never died, but I spent a good number of hours wondering if he had, only to find out that no, he had just forgotten to leave, forgotten to call, forgotten to remember me. Dad's face was a collage made of running shoes, records, Diet Pepsi, glass jars, and golf clubs. People said he was handsome and that we looked alike. People also said we were all made in God's image, but you could never actually see God, so what did that mean? Buckled into Dad's car, I could hear Mom's car start to pull away, and it was as if part of my body were driving away, too. I remember the moment of being situated in my father's car, screaming for her. He snarled back at me that this was his time. Why didn't I want to be with him? "I was bad," he said. My attire in those days was varied, trending in a masculine direction. I had a long pirate phase, which was good because lady pirates dressed just like boy pirates, so I wasn't necessarily cross-dressing unless you thought about it a little bit. "What are you wearing?" he inevitably asked. "I'm a pirate," I snapped back. I could feel Mom smiling from afar at my statement, but I could feel his annoyance, his self-consciousness of his pirate daughter, wearing her big hat with a feather in it and a plastic hook over her hand as we walked into the Breezewood McDonald's. "There weren't any girl pirates," he said. "Yes, there were," I corrected him, and he didn't like this. "Well, none of them had hooks," he snapped. He had me there. I had not read of any female pirates with hooks. I didn't care, though. I was pretending. "I'm being a boy," I shrugged. I didn't know I'd said anything wrong, but he was angry now, not just annoyed. "Stop that," he said, tugging the hand he was holding too hard so my elbow hurt. We were at the register, the woman behind the counter waiting for our order. "Stop what?" I asked, confused. I felt tears welling up in my eyes now that everyone was looking at us. "You want to be a boy? Boys don't cry." My dad would repeat this throughout my life every time I cried. After a while, he didn't have to say it anymore. He'd just smirk at me, making that same point over and over again. When I was old enough to sit in the front seat on the drive home, he would keep his hand on my thigh for the whole 4-hour trip, and if I said anything he didn't like, he'd squeeze his big hand around my leg tight enough to cut off my circulation. When he liked what I was saying, he'd caress my leg and tell me how much he loved me, how great I was. If I said or did anything he really didn't like, he'd just stop talking to me or tell me I was bad. That's when I learned how to perform in his company, how to make the outside of me so different from the inside that sometimes it was better to say nothing and that sometimes you had to outright lie to keep your blood flowing. Chapter 3. You're Never Fully Dressed Without a Smile. 1992. A ballet recital generally constituted a horrible day for everyone involved. The parking lot for the dance hall was filled with kids in sticky, shiny costumes that poked and jabbed in random places, and frantic parents running around holding tutus and lipstick and flowers. When I had a dance recital, Dad drove to Maryland to see it, and we'd drive back for the first 2 weeks of summer. I'd hold my breath for a few days, knowing they'd all be in the same room, and then I'd be alone with him in a blank space I could never piece together. I tried not to think about him and tried not to rip my costume. Mom kissed me on the forehead, and I walked into the basement of the building where I was supposed to sit with my dance class until it was our turn to perform. I loved dancing, but I hated getting dressed up in girl clothes. I glanced ruefully at the two boys in the school who got to wear tuxedos and got treated with kid gloves so they wouldn't quit and leave the school with no boys at all. I kept saying I could be a boy, I could play a boy, I could look just like a boy, but people reacted like I was saying I could be a bird or a unicorn with a hearty laugh or a nervous side glance or a mix of the two. My class of 8 to 10-year-old girls was sitting in a circle on the concrete basement floor, stretching and talking as I approached. "Rebecca," Chrissy exclaimed, "you've got makeup on and everything. I can't believe you're wearing a skirt. How does it feel?" Our dance teacher walked by and squeezed me on the shoulder encouragingly. "You clean up good, Mertz," she said, smiling sympathetically with me but not at me. She was like a boy too. When she walked away, Chrissy looked at me and said to everyone else, "Miss Jane is a lesbian." The other girls giggled and some looked away shyly. "What's a lesbian?" I asked. "You are," Chrissy said, and I could tell by the way she said it that she was certain and that it was bad. Still, at that moment, I was more nervous about going out there in front of everyone and being a girl than I was about being a lesbian. I thought about Miss Jane and all the ways we were alike, and I felt like I knew what a lesbian was, and I probably was one. I just wish I could dance in pants without a tutu. In boy clothes, I felt like there was some possibility of people seeing me, but the girlier the clothes were, the more I became something else. Wearing frilly pink tulle or sequined lace-up bodices up there in front of everyone felt about as wrong as if I'd been wearing a costume of genitals. I focused on practicing the part of the routine that always threw me off, and Miss Kelly, another dance teacher, came over to see if I was okay. "I have to go to my dad's today," I admitted. "I don't want to." My hands were raised above my head, and I was trying to make them look like they were supposed to, like they were graceful. "You've got to relax," Miss Kelly said, taking my hands in hers and standing right there in front of me. She was one of the teenagers who helped out with our class, and she was always nice to me. She shook my hands a little and said, "Wow, you really don't want to go to your dad's, huh?" "Yeah," I managed to say, because I knew better than to say anything else, and because I couldn't think about that right now. She was holding my hands, and her face was very close to mine. "You've got to shake it out, okay? Can you shake for me?" I shook out my arms and legs, and she smiled and said I still needed to relax. She put her hands on my hips and then my shoulders, and I straightened my back and felt all the muscles in my body get hard and alert. "You're tense all over," she said. "Maybe it's more in your personality." "I think so," I said, and she laughed again in a way that made me feel like it was okay to be whatever I was. I had no idea what she meant by relax. Moments later, we were out on the stage together, poised and controlled and delicate-looking. My mind locked into performance mode, and I forgot everything except my body and what I was supposed to do with it. I could see the shape of my dad in the audience in the shadows, clapping proudly when we were done, and I stood there grinning, looking like I knew he wanted me to look. On the wall of Mom and Bob's house in Maryland, there was a picture of me at 9 or 10, wearing a purple ballet costume, a backward baseball cap, and red Converse high tops. I posed with my arms spread out wide and a big grin on my face. I was headed into a ballet recital, just before I quit ballet. At first, people thought it was funny that I was wearing those sneakers with my ballet outfit. But as I got older, people...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?